Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome back to the Mike Force Podcast. It is, of course, your host, Mike G. I'm sticking with that intro. If you're listening to this podcast, we are a sponsored podcast, but most importantly, we're partnered with companies we believe in. The first sponsor I want to talk about is BetterHelp. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. There's a lot of people who are not realizing that there's something interfering with their happiness or preventing them from achieving their goals. And likely, it starts with communication. You could start that in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. This isn't like self-help. It's professional therapy. One of the best things I did was use professional therapy and navigating my own mind. It's like the diagnostic. When you understand it, it helps you manage it in real time versus after the fact when things have already fallen apart. There's a broad range of expertise available, and it might not be available locally in your specific area. That's why they use a client base that's worldwide. You can log into your account anytime, send a message to your therapist, and get timely and thoughtful responses. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches. And look, you don't have to stand in a line. Who wants to stand in a line and just deal with a couple options when you could have a broad myriad of options? So if you visit betterhelp.com, that's HELP.com/MikeForce, you could join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. Preparedness starts with your mindset. And you want a better mindset? Get the mental hygiene that you need with betterhelp.com. On this special, if you go there, you can get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/MikeForce. We're also sponsored by Element. That's L-M-N-T. Lima, Mike, November, Tango. So if you eat a whole foods diet like I do, a pretty clean diet, you're not going to have as much sodium, and you need to replenish that sodium and make up with it with electrolytes. Look, if you do anything that requires physical activity, it's likely that you're draining and exhausting your electrolytes. When I was in the infantry, drinking water was the answer to everything. Got a headache? Drink water. Feeling weak? Drink water. Except when you just drink water, you flush your electrolytes and you need that sodium. Look, Drink Element is a healthy alternative to sugary electrolyte drinks. Each grab-and-go stick pack replaces essential electrolytes. No sugar, no coloring, no artificial ingredients or junk. I drink Element every day to support my low-carb diet, my workouts, my rucks, my hunts. As a member of our community, Element has a very special offer for you, so you can claim your free Element sample pack by going to drinkelement.com. That's L-M-N-T, Lima Mike November Tango.com /MikeForce to get your free sample pack. It's like $5. Once you get it, I already know you're going to subscribe, and it's going to be part of your daily routine, and this is what it's about. Preparedness is about optimized and efficient routines and habits that make you better prepared. And do that with drinkelement.com. Hey guys, I want to go straight into the podcast because this podcast, we're post-reflecting on the journey of a recent hunt. Now, I like doing these because they're fresh on my mind, so I could talk to you about lessons learned, but I could also express to you the importance of being more self-reliant and how that lends itself to being better prepared. A lot of us depend on systems, on whether that's supply chain, institution. We depend on these systems because it makes our life convenient. And that's a thing, right? I don't want to ever state that that's not a thing and not significant, because time is important. Efficiency is important. The problem is when we have so much dependency on these systems that we're not paying attention, to the detriment of putting all of our eggs in one basket and what that could mean if that system fails. Let's talk about the hunting application. Why do I want to advocate for you to hunt? Well, one, I think in the journey of becoming a hunter, you'll be better. You'll be more resilient. You'll be better physically prepared, and you'll be better technically prepared. Oh, and by the way, you're also going to be less dependent on a system. That system is factory farming. So here's what you need to do. Open your fridge and look at your own habits. What are the things that you buy all the time from your local supermarket, likely a food chain, and how much of that do you consume, and how much of that is tied to a factory farm that is mass distributing meat or vegetables or whatever it is that's in your fridge? That could be problematic. One, I'm not a fan of factory farming because I believe there's a lot of local geographical farms and ranches that could provide that food from their ranch, their farm, to your plate in your home. And yes, it's more expensive, likely, but also you're supporting your community and you're less dependent on this system. Because what happens here, let's entertain this. Let's say the system or the infrastructure collapses. So I'm in business, right? I deal with international supply chains. It's part of being in business, especially tied to retail. So if you take a company, let's say you take a company that does all its business overseas in China, which is a lot of companies, but all of their business is done in China. If China, which right now is doing this, but if China decides we're no longer going to support supply chains going into America, which they never will do that because it would devastate their own economy, then what does that mean for that business? Well, it means they have no resilience because they're not diversified. And also, they should be looking at diversifying, not just because of security, but because it's the right thing to do. I've always struggled with a balance between being in business, but being an ethical American business. What that means to me is I want to support American people, citizens. So I want to employ Americans. I want to do my best in navigating what I could manufacture and produce in America, and even looking at raw materials that we could source. So that's why I have Fieldcraft Frontier. I mean, the leather line of the things that I do, all the stuff that's online that's made of leather is made in the USA in one of our buildings here in Heber City, Utah, via my leathersmith. In fact, if you go to at Fieldcraft Frontier, you'll be able to see the suite of things that we make that are made in the USA and craftsmanship applied. So some things you're not going to do in America, like a little widget, a piece of plastic or whatever that is. There's not many places you'll find Americans in factories doing that. So you got to outsource that. But things like leather, steel, custom wood making, those things take a craftsman, an American. And I think that's important. Does it scale? Not really. I mean, you could hire 100 craftsmen making, 100 different things, but it's more custom, more niche. And I like that though. Like if I, you know, I'm holding right now this Fieldcraft Frontier tourniquet holder, and it holds a Cat 7 tourniquet or a soft tee. And the quality of it is beautiful. It aesthetically looks good and it feels good. And I like the fact that this is made in the USA. So when we diversify systems like that, even in business, you're setting yourself up for success. Take that same model and apply it to your life. The electricity. Do you even know the electricity and where the base station for that electricity is? The water running to your home. What happens if the water system breaks down? Do you have contingencies? How are you powering your house? When the electricity goes out, do you have a generator? These redundant systems are not just important in infrastructure, but they're important in your own habits. So you go to Walmart and you get everything you need. It's very convenient. That's why it's so popular. So what happens when that supply chain is broken? Pre-COVID, we had no idea what that looked like. COVID happens, people freak out, and then the next thing you know, all the shelves are empty. Imagine the fuel. Imagine you can't get gas or diesel. What do you do then? Do you have bikes? Do you have renewable resources of energy to be able to transport yourself or your family? We have to think about these things. What I love about hunting, just like overlanding, which I talked about recently, is you're in this world that if you just pay attention and you do all the things that you would do normally and being prepared for hunting, you are setting your life up for success. So let's break it down a little bit. Let's break it down via my hunt, because my hunt was different than normal hunts. So I decided, man, I want to do a mule deer hunt. Mule deer in North America are, in my opinion, the most beautiful species of game in America that you can hunt. Not only just because they're aesthetically beautiful, their habits, their nature, their elusiveness is all beautiful. I grew up in North Carolina where whitetail, I mean, you could corn feed whitetail in your front yard. So when you see a mule deer, you know it's wild. It will let you know it's wild because you won't get near it. So I was given the opportunity through Sportsman's Warehouse, who we are selling our new magnet retention holster through. They gave me a slot for what's called a Deseret hunt, which is Deseret, Utah, a ranch in Utah that has hundreds of thousands of acres that's known for its conservation, its preservation of wildlife, and not tainting the environment with too much pressure, too much hunting. And it has a science behind it, but it's a beautiful thing. So it's almost guaranteed that you're going to get something, but it's also closely connected to this conservation. So when I was asked by John Barker, the CEO, one, I was humbled and honored. Two, I was like, yes, yes, and yes. I'm not going to give that up. I would definitely do that. And it was rifle deer. That was the tag. So in the state of Utah, you have to have a hunter education number, which I did in North Carolina a long, long, long time ago. Also did it in Arizona. And you got to take hunter safety, and then you can apply for a tag. Now, if it's to an outfitter, which this in this case it was, they provide the tag because they get the tags, and then they're just allocating it towards you. So there's paperwork involved. I just came from Arizona, and then before Arizona, Colorado, where each of those experiences are different when trying to get a tag. Like, for you to get a tag in Arizona, it seemed almost impossible. I mean, I never got a tag in Arizona. Well, I got over-the-counter tags, which means you walk to the counter and they allocate the state through the Bureau of Land Management. And I'm probably getting that wrong. I don't know specifically how the tags are distroed or disseminated in Arizona. But you buy the tag from, you can go to Walmart and buy an over-the-counter tag in the outdoor sporting goods section. You get that tag over the counter, and then you go to the area or the zone where that tag can, where you could shoot or harvest that animal. And most likely you're not going to fill that tag, because if it's over the counter, they want to apply the pressure in that area, but it's very difficult. Unless you've glassed it, where you've done reconnaissance and kind of know the lay of the land, the statistical probability of a successful hunt is low. If you do a guided hunt, it becomes higher, because the guided hunt, the guides work for the outfitters. So the outfitters provide the guides who understand the terrain. So my last bull elk archery hunt in Idaho with Mark, he knew the terrain. He knew exactly where elk bed down. He knew the behavior. He knew the cycles. And it was like being with the Farmer's Almanac, like a source for information that makes it more probable that you're going to be successful. So in the lead up to this, I had to get my crap together. I have an archery set up. I'm set up for that, but not for a rifle. Now, I do have lots of rifles, but the start point for understanding what caliber and what rifle you need is understanding the terrain. So 8,000 to 9,000 feet, you could use vehicles on main roads, dirt roads, and then you got to break down into the wood line to be able to get into position in these specific areas. So I knew I was hunting deer. Well, I didn't want a 300 Win Mag for deer. For elk, which is much bigger, obviously you want a bigger caliber, more foot-pounds of energy. And with a 300 Win Mag into a deer, I don't want to destroy the animal. And so I opted to do a 308, except my 308, which is 7.62 by 51 millimeter, is a LaRue OBR gas gun. It's like an AR-10 gas gun. The problem with that gas gun isn't that it's not accurate, because it's one of the most accurate guns I have. It's that that specific gun is made for war. So it has a quad Picatinny rail to mount accessories, and it's super heavy because it's made for like this mil-spec idea where it needs to be ruggedized and ready for combat. The same rifles that I used in combat would not make very good guns or rifles for hunting. Imagine carrying a gun that weighs 12 pounds around the Sawtooth Mountains or high elevation where you're climbing through ridgelines and valleys. That would be so taxing. So I went, hey, what's the best rifle for hunting? Luckily, I have a relationship with SIG, and I know Dan Horner, some of the guys who work for SIG that helped design the SIG Cross, which is their rifle line of hunting rifle. So I got a SIG Cross chambered in 308, and I had to look at scope options. When looking at scope options, I was amiss, man. A lot of people think the more magnification, the better. Well, that's true to a point. If you're hunting elk, where you expect to get distance because they're elusive, that's a different consideration in open plains than in the woods or the pines or the oaks of the mountains of Utah. Because you could shoot an elk within 100 yards. I mean, you could shoot a elk with a bow within 25 yards because you're physically calling them in. So when you look at deer, you're not calling them in. You're actually trying to spot, assess where they're at, and then you got to stalk on them. You got to move on them or set up on them in some way. So I needed magnification, but I didn't want to over magnify, because if I took my 300 Win Mag and I have a 25 power Vortex optic, and I go to look in the optic, and at 100 to 200 yards, I have to worry about dialing out because I'm dialed in, that could be problematic. So I also wanted, in the actual form or size of the scope, I didn't want a huge monster of a scope on top of it, because I didn't want the weight, and I just wanted something more compact. So the PRS is super light because it uses aluminum. I think everything's aluminum besides the bolt and the barrel, the action group. So super light. Put on a Harris bipod that has a couple points of adjustment for 6 to 9 inches to get a little bit of elevation when shooting flat or on a different surface or obstacle. And I took the Leupold Mark V, which is an old Leupold optic, and I put that on my SIG Cross. Now, when you put an optic on a gun, you need to zero it. A typical zero for a rifle is 100 yards. During my carbine classes, I asked my students to say, hey, what does a zero mean to you? What I've realized over the years is that's very different depending on who the person is. So if I said to you right now, like, what's your zero? And you say, oh, 100 yards. No. I mean, when do you consider your rifle to be zeroed? Is it one shot? Is it two shots? Is it five shots? And then what is the discrepancy that you're comfortable with in saying my gun is now zeroed? Is it three rounds inside of a 1-inch circle? Like, what does that mean? So for me, I shot a 1-inch group with 5 rounds at 100 yards, which is very good for a rifle. That's very good for a out-of-the-box rifle that's used for hunting. That's super lightweight. So I shot 5 rounds, which is, in this case, .308, which is the caliber, but that's the size of the width of the round in inches. Also, there's a metric version of that, which is 7.62 by 51 millimeters. So I took a SIG 168 grain, which is the weight of the bullet, and I put 5 rounds through a 1-inch pasty at 100 yards. So in doing that, I say to myself, I am confirmed at 100. But that's just the start point, because now I need to identify what are my holds at different ranges for that gun and that optic. So it's called DOPE, and it's a sniper term or phraseology. It's an acronym that stands for data on previous engagements. So I need to know how much I need to hold over, or in fact, even under, depending on the ranges. So if I'm at 200 yards, my hold at 100 is going to be different. If I'm at 300 yards, my hold where my reticle is staged on the target is going to be different than at 200. In fact, I'll tell you, because I use mil radians, which is a unit of measure. And if you're not tracking, I'm not trying to make this a class about ballistics, but at 250 yards, my hold, or at 200 yards, my hold is very different than my 1.3 mils hold at 300 yards, which just means in my circumstance with the deer that I was shooting, it went from 200 yards to 300 yards really fast. So if I didn't know my holds and wasn't comfortable with what my gun did at different distances, I wouldn't have been able to take that shot and ethically put that animal down. So what I'll tell you is it requires a lot of training and experience that you could build in your training. So if you practice, don't just practice like the technical static, everything's going right. Practice the everything potentially is changing, not going wrong, but changing. So if you're, for example, in my case where the deer was at 200 and then he quickly fled where he's getting 275 to 300, you need to be able to do rapid engagement processes of thinking, okay, he's at 200. That's a 0.9 hold. Oh, actually for me, it's like a 0.5 hold, like half mil. Oh no, he's moving to 300. Now I need to make that adjustment. And by the way, if you're doing it without a guide, you're assuming the adjustment based on what you're seeing. So you need to practice estimating distance with the naked eye or through an optic. Because if I didn't have the experience of knowing generally what distance he was changing from 200 to 300 meters or 200 to 300 yards, I would have just assumed that he'd move, but I wasn't sure how far he moved. And I potentially could have sent a shot that I would have been unethical. So the reason this is important in context is because it gives you a minor glimpse, a small glimpse into the big picture, which is what is required to become the best hunter that you could be. Because you can go on the woodline. In fact, I was with a guy who didn't have a lot of experience, a ton of experience. I don't think he's ever looked through an optic. And he harvested a monster bull elk on this hunt because he had a very good guide. So if you want to get into hunting, you could pick a good outfitter, pick a good guide, and then let that guide educate you on these things, making sure that you're asking lots of questions. And that's a good start point for hunting. I was always that guy who was like, I'm not going to use a guide. I'm my own man. I don't need that. Well, what I realized, especially in hunting in the backcountry, is the guide is going to give you the best chances of success, but the best chance of learning in a short period of time. So if I take my, you know, sniper experience leading up in preparation for the hunt, and then that overall experience, I'm best setting myself up for success. So here's how it went down. So I get to Deseret, me and Austin get to Deseret, my media guy, Austin, it's Savage Lester on Instagram. We get there and we link up with our guide and he tells us, hey, we're going to go out. We go out and we're in the mountains of some of the most beautiful country I've ever seen. I don't think I'll ever forget this valley. We walked out over the high ground, and as we're walking out, a large coyote, a massive coyote, is silhouetting the horizon on top of one of the ridge lines running down into this valley. Like the ridge line is the high ground that's surrounded by low ground that takes usually high to low or low to high and runs into valleys. In this case, it did. So imagine I'm on a ridge line walking into low ground from the high ground. So I'm coming down in elevation, but I'm still, 500 yards above the valley floor, which has a creek that goes through the valley. And I look off to the left, and on an adjacent ridge line, there's a coyote 500 yards away, silhouetted in the horizon. And I look through my I had SIG rangefinders that had 10 by 42, and ranged him, and then saw him and was like, wow, majestic. The guide gets us into that valley about 300 meters above the valley floor. And we look down from left to right, spanning about 1,500 meters. Or you could use yards. I use meters because I'm a military guy. Use yards, 15 football fields from left to right. And you have the most dense population of elk I've ever seen in my life. You had approximately 60 elk and about 10 bulls, with about 5 to 6 bulls that were bugling the entire time we were there. So if you, I like to use Narnia. I've never even watched it, but if you use like the analogy of like a fantasy world, it didn't even seem real. I mean, Austin was joking that it looked like a virtual simulator. Like if you shot around into that area, the glass would break because it'd be a monitor and a nerd behind a computer building the ones and zeros. It didn't seem real. So we spent the first evening taking in the environment, which is important, and getting a feel for patterns of life, what bulls were doing, which they were running hard, they were bugling, they were corralling their cows, their female elk, and deer wasn't even on the menu. Because I was with a hunter that had an elk tag with a guide that was guiding us both. So the next morning, we get a different guide because our guide had to go in a meeting. Big shout out to Scott, my guide. And we decide to hard focus on the deer. So I got my whole setup. I am sick from head to toe because I like the pattern, but I also like the clothing. And I have a Sitka chest rig. There's a couple things I want to change on it. I might talk to Sitka about that, or we might make our own. I have survival in my right pocket, survival gear, or survival gear that we sell on online, med in my left, and I have my binos in the center. And I have a Kefaru pack, but because of the way the hunt was, I didn't have to sustain life via my pack. Because the way this whole ranch was set up, you could drive to an area, you dismounted, and then you went into the wood line or you went to the mountains and you did your hunt, but you were always within a couple miles of your vehicle. So I didn't have to pack heavy. I used a Kefaru pack that was super light and was able to navigate around lighter than I'm used to. So I didn't have a sling on the gun because I wanted to be prepared to take up a shot if I had to, because we're talking about deer here. With elk, you would potentially, depending on tactics, obviously, you would potentially bed down, start calling, and let that bull in the rut come to you and then take that shot offset. If you're using a guide to call or yourself to call, the bull would come to you. In this situation, you could be walking and you could run into a herd of mature mule deer buck and then have to take the shot in a rapid engagement scenario. So I carried the gun in my hand and I was prepared, in this case, in the vehicle as we were driving, to dismount and get into a position to take a shot just in case. Because it's not illegal to spot from the road, it's just illegal to shoot from your vehicle. So obviously we're not doing that. So we're glassing some ridge lines. We stop and my guide sees movement. So even before that, we were out glassing and he knew where he was going to take us. So we're kind of moving from one point to another. And as we get out of the vehicle and get kind of established, we look across an open field. In this open field, there's three buck that run from the wood line. So imagine you're looking at woods. And you have woods, a clear opening, which looks like a pasture, and then more woods. So an opening where you have an opportunity potentially. So when these three buck come out, I immediately go prone. I back out my magnification because I can't see when I first look into my objective lens because, or into my scope through the objective lens because I'm focused at 18 power. So I need to be able to, by the naked eye, establish where these guys are and then go to my optic. But I was so close because of the magnification, I had to back it out. So lesson learned, roll back your magnification. It's better to dial in than have to dial out because dialed out, you could break the shot still, dialed too far in and you have to readjust. So I dialed out, the estimates are to about 10 power and I could see all three deer. They're at about 200 yards and they're kind of galloping and then they stop and they reset and then they continue movement. When I'm watching them, I'm identifying antlers. Not because I'm sport hunting, but because on this particular ranch, just like I think mindset-wise you should do in the first place, I want to kill a mature animal that has had a full life and a mature life, and that can be demonstrated with the antler. So bigger isn't necessarily better, but you want to shoot an animal, in this case, that was above 4 or 5 years old. So mule deer, according to the education that I got in that area, 7 to 8 years old in lifespan typically. And I was looking for that and didn't see it because the three buck that I was looking were super young. And so I was like, oh, well, I'm disappointed. Then the guide tells me, because remember, we're trying to communicate to each other while we're trying to get on glass, shoot a range find to the distance to the animals, and call wind, get environmental information. All this stuff is happening at once. So I said, hey, these guys aren't. And then he stops me and points me in the direction of the woodline because that none of those deer were the deer he saw. We're talking about a guide who has identified most animals in this area and has even tracked their behavior because he's glassed them and watched and observed their behavior. So he says, no, those aren't it. And that's not what I saw. So meaning the three buck that I saw weren't part of what he saw. So the big buck that he saw was still out there. So I was like, oh, okay, cool. There might be an opportunity here. So in the wood line, the buck that he saw was still there. He just had identified where we were at and stopped. Now, remember, we're trying to be quiet. We're communicating in whispers, and we're not making a lot of bold movements because we don't want to tip off the deer. The wind's right, meaning we're upwind. We're not down, or the deer isn't downwind of us, so he's not going to smell us, but he could still identify contrast, and then you know they see gray essentially in colors. So we need to be still. We can't move. So we're basically whispering, frozen in position, and he says, I see him. And as soon as he says that, the deer breaks out of the wood line and starts moving from what initially was assessed at 200 yards, sprinting diagonally across this open field. And I get in the scope at 10 power, and I see him. And I'm tracking him while he's moving on bipods. Now, let me tell you a mistake I almost made. I almost didn't have bipods on the gun because I said to myself, well, if you're on bipods, you're not going to be able to shoot from the ground because there's too much grass. So you're going to need a bag. So I was prepared to shoot off my Kafaru bag, except in this circumstance, I didn't have the bag with me. So I didn't have the ability to traverse the gun off a bag because I wasn't staged on a bag. So I just had the bipods on the ground, laying in the prone, and was able to see clearly into that field. Now, if it was woodline, if I was offset with more vegetation, likely wouldn't have been able to see it. Thank God I had the bipods on the gun. So I track the moving deer, and he's telling me, hey, he's running. And I'm thinking in my head, oh man, this is beautiful, because I see the massive, and there weren't massive, but I see large antlers, which means it's prime for harvesting, but I don't see the opportunity to shoot because he's moving and I'm seeing his butt and like the side of him. And I'm not going to take a shot while he's moving. I'm good, but I'm not that good. So he's moving and I'm like, you know, what now? So I don't know if I say this, but I'm like, man, he needs to stop him. And the guide on call, like he was reading my mind. I don't think I said this out loud. He makes I believe he did a cow call, which is a female elk call. So he does a cow call. And I don't even know if it was a cow call, to be honest. It was some noise. And it stops him. And right when he stops dead in his track on his path, and he turns and looks over his right shoulder right at me. So in hunting, you want to hit an animal broadside, because when they're broadside, the bullet or the arrow will pass evenly through them, guaranteeing an ethical kill. This deer was at an angle. So I knew if I wanted to hit him through and through, which is the objective, that I still had a little real estate to work with, but I would have to be behind the right shoulder around 6 inches, which would put me through the other side of him, not compromising the left shoulder. And because obviously if you got close to behind the shoulder, in this case, it would went through his chest. So I had to back it up. So I held to the left about 6 inches, and I knew my hold. My hold at 300 yards was 1.3. My hold at 200 yards was 0.5. And my hold at 250 yards was 0.9. I just knew I needed to be between 0.9 and 1.3. So I held a heavy 1.1-ish, 1.2, because it's marked every 2/10. So I held 1.2, favored a little left of the right shoulder, and I broke the shot as clean as I could break it. One, I staged the trigger because it's a two-stage trigger on that SIG cross, and was able to break that shot clean, stay in the glass, rack the bolt, and be set up for the next shot, except when I looked through the glass, he was no longer there. So I put it on safe. I sit up off the ground, and I get feedback on his movement, because when you're in glass, especially magnified in, it's hard to identify potentially where the animal went. So immediately the guide gave me feedback, which is the benefit of a spot or a guide, a second person, that it looked like a heart shot. And he said, you smoked him. So when that happens, you need to take a step back, because in that situation, the animal is dying and you need to allow it to die, which happens fast, but you need to give it some time. So you got to be tactically patient. You can't just run into the wood line because you're putting yourself in danger. And to be honest, like, you need to allow nature and the hunt to take its course. So we stood quietly for a couple minutes and decided to start tracking it in. Now, your mindset needs to shift, because you took a shot on a live animal and you need to be prepared to ethically put down, humanely put down that animal if it's still alive, if it's suffering. That's why you give it time, right? The objective is to shoot, you know, some people refer to as double lunging, where you're putting the round broadside through behind the shoulders, depending on the animal, and through the pump house, because that immediately starts massive hemorrhaging, which is bleeding, which leads to the animal essentially passing out and expiring rapidly, right? Especially under adrenaline, which the animal is in after being hit so violently. So my mindset was, I picked up my rifle and I carried it in a position where I could immediately dispatch an animal if it was still alive. So what we're looking for is blood. But some of the characteristics of bleeding change depending on where the shot's placed, the caliber of the round, even the composition of the round. Oh, is it bonded? Is it full metal jacket? Just depending on the situation. So I'm using full metal jacket, of course, the legal ammunition to kill, ethically kill an animal, 168 grain. And we don't find any initial blood, which is common. So what you're likely to see is spots or splashes of blood. And then as you continue to move, because the heart or pump house is pushing this, you'll see more significant traces of blood. So this is obviously, this is not my first deer hunt. So I'm tracking, and Austin identifies disturbed earth. So it's very easy to see disturbed earth. Also, Austin is a member of the search and rescue. He's been to tracking schools. We see that disturbed earth and start tracking that as our primary and run into the first spot of blood. If you go on my Instagram, mike.a.glover, you could actually find that video on IGTV on my personal account where I take you through the trail of where we track the deer. So we find a significant puddle of blood, which is a good sign, about 10 yards from where I took the shot. And then about 10 yards later, more significant signs, including a branch completely full of blood where the deer likely ran into the limb of this tree, broke it, and then fell into the grass. So we discover him, and he's, you go in and you want to poke and make sure that the animal is actually dead, and he's dead. So from the time or the place that I shot him, he moved about 20-ish yards and literally slumped over and died in the grass in peace, probably a couple seconds after he was shot. So when I saw him, when I saw the shots with the entry wound and an exit wound, I knew immediately that it was an ethical and perfect shot to end this beautiful animal's life with no pain. You imagine you get hit, the adrenaline flows through you, you get opiates dumped in your system, the cortisol is dumped in your system, and you feel numb, you're bleeding internally, and I'm not trying to freak anybody out here, but this is kind of the process, the biological process of how this works. Bleeding internally, and simply the lights go out. No pain. No ability to fight. It's just there's nothing left because all the blood has flowed through into that wound. And then he simply falls down on the ground and expires. That's what we always hope to accomplish in a hunt. So when I understood kind of the forensics of it and just assessing where the shot was taken, where he was at, I immediately got this feeling, this overwhelming sense of accomplishment, but also respect for that animal. The deer that I shot was estimated to be between 5 and 6 years old. Not a lot of people who look at hunting understand how animals live and die in the wild. If you're an animal and you get a scrape, a cut, you get in a fight, and you get an infection, you get an abscess, you die a miserable death because obviously wild animals aren't getting treated. They get drugged down by coyotes, by wolves, by cats, by predators. Most often, these animals don't die in peace. And so when you're harvesting an animal, the objective is ethical killing of the animal, but also respect. And so this animal was 5 to 6 years old, beautiful mule deer. I don't pay attention to the points, the width, but the guide that I was with said the symmetry, the age, the markings, everything that was perfect mule deer. So a beautiful example of the species and of a long life lived, so much so that he said we harvested him before he rutted really hard because the indication was in the fat content. Again, I'm not an expert on parastoring here, paraphrasing, that he had what we determined was 2 inches of fat on his back. So he's super healthy, and he wasn't kind of what you would see from a mule deer that was hard in the rut, and he was primed for winter survival, and it was the perfect time for his life to come to an end in that situation. Like, everything came together. we winded up quartering him and doing a couple of things that I'll just keep private because they're little ceremonies that hunters do across the nation that respect life and respect animals. Even some Native American traditions that me and Austin did after the fact, because I take it serious. Taking a life, which I've taken many human lives in war, isn't something that I think is a joke, isn't something that I think is funny, isn't something that I take lightly. And that translates to hunting as well. But here's what I know. I know that when I'm eating that mule deer, when my family and friends are eating that mule deer, I know where it lived. I know its patterns of life. I know the last meal it ate. I know what it felt like to take that animal's life. But most significantly, I appreciate all of that cycle in life every single time I break bread with my community, with my family, with my friends. That's something that we're so disconnected from that it's disgusting. Because you have advocates who are fighting hunters and fighting conservation because we're killers, but they're eating a Whopper from BK. They're buying, you know, they're at the fancy restaurant buying the meal that they pretend wasn't a live animal. The difference for me in this is I know where that life ended. And I take pride in the ethical and humane way that it, that life ended, and then the process of that journey where me and that animal came together. So when I put substance in my body, in my family's body, in my community's body, it means more to me than just going out and peeling the plastic wrap back and stuffing my face with food that I have no idea or understanding where it came from. The overall experience was epic. That's the only word that I could come up with. And it's something that I want all of you to experience. It's something that I'm very passionate about. I always have been, by the way, because I grew up a fisherman. My dad was a fisherman, still is. I fished 3 to 4 days of my life every week from the ages of like as long as I could remember to my teenage years. Went in the military, got busy with a lot of things, but now that I'm out, I'm getting back to the grassroots of things, and so should you. I hope you enjoyed that conversation for the experience. I want to end with a question related to preparedness before I end the podcast. The question is, I have a teenage daughter. She's getting her driver's license soon. We talk a lot about being situationally aware all the time, and her and I are taking a women's self-defense class together. I bought her pepper spray for a keychain. Is there any other suggestions for a young girl gaining some independence to stay safe? She's petite, gets plenty of stares from grown men, so it makes me nervous. She will soon be doing things alone, and I want her to be the most prepared. Well, one, thank you. That's significant and important as a mama bear, but thank you for asking that question. Here's a breakdown. Situational awareness and the understanding of how bad people exploit good people is the start point. Women are exploited most often in their routines, where they're the most complacent, and because they're women. I mean, statistically, women are the victims of violent acts, especially violent sexual acts, including assault and rape, because a 240-pound man can dominate a 120-pound woman. It's just the laws of physics. So when you think about preparedness and you're a young person, male or female, you should start thinking about being situationally aware. And that means you're conscious and you're aware of your environment at all times, especially where you're most exploitable. The example is the gas station. I always use this example because it's mostly common to all. Even electric cars need to be topped off through power, which could be exploited. You go into a gas station and the routine is the same. So if a bad guy was looking at that routine, he would hit you when you're not paying attention because you're in the routine of things. So you get out of your car, you put your credit card in, you pump the gas, and then you're on your phone staring at it with your door unlocked. Or maybe even standing outside with your hands in your pocket, staring at the ground. So what I like to think about is young people and old people should always be creating deliberate, conscious processes in order to be switched on. So when I pump gas, I don't stare at my phone. When I pump gas, I'm kicking tires, walking around my vehicle, looking over my vehicle or through my vehicle, getting situational awareness, and taking in information. Now, information or a plan without tactics to manage the plan is a poor plan. So we need to go, what happens if this happens? And that's a conversation. Honey, if you're in a gas station and you see a guy who's creeping on you, and he's looking at you from across the gas station, and he yells at you because he wants to get your number or he seems creepy, what are you going to do? The answer is not, well, I don't know. I guess I'll figure it out. The answer can be definitive because you could say, honey, or this is what I'm going to do. If you're ever in a situation where you feel uncomfortable, action is better than no action. So I'm not going to just go, oh, this seems weird. I'm literally physically going to do something. In this case, I would advise that your daughter, if she's feels uncomfortable with the presence of anybody that's making her uncomfortable, for her immediately and physically to get out of that situation as soon as possible. So in this case, because we could brainstorm this and we could entertain the scenario in any capacity, it doesn't matter where she's at. In this case, she's taking the gas. It doesn't matter how much gas she has in the car. She's offloading it, sticking it back into the gas pump and getting her vehicle, locking the doors and driving away, especially if she's by herself. Even if she's not, she's communicating to her friends or her family the intent, this guy is not making me feel comfortable. We need to get out of here. The tethering to communications is important as well. The reason you would call 911 isn't an expectation that they would be your first response, because the average time is too much time to respond to an act that's likely already happened, a shooting, an assault, a kidnapping. So the understanding is if you call out to dispatch and they get people inbound or en route, then you're giving an opportunity for situational awareness for you to use your own tactics and mitigating risk while somebody is on the way to potentially save you. Because your own actions on the X where the bad event happens is how you're going to save your own life. Not the phone call, not the police that are arriving, because it will all be too late. But you need to be tethered to communications, which means you might say to your friend, hey, if I tell you to call 911, if I look at you, or if you think the situation starts unfolding weird, you better get on the phone. You're in a better position than I am. Or on your own phone. Have it staged, have it ready to communicate. Also, don't be afraid in specific instances to get loud, right? If you want to mitigate risk, well, if somebody's trying to be sneaky or malicious, they don't want attention. So yelling, screaming, you're making me feel uncomfortable, help, whatever that looks like, that is a tactic. When you gave your daughter pepper spray, did you know what you were giving it to her for? A lot of people don't know what that means. Pepper spray against an assailant who's willing to and able to do damage it's not going to be as much affected by somebody who has a hasty plan. Like if somebody is going to do damage, they are going to work through that pain and do whatever they have to make that happen. Somebody who's hastily doing it, like opportunistic, might be a different circumstance. So what I tell people with the pepper spray isn't the offensive tactic. Pepper spray is to create distance and create time for you to get away from the threat. So you're in your car, the doors are locked, the windows are up, and he shatters the window. You hit him with pepper spray, but your main tactic is driving away. So I'm using the pepper spray to create distance and breaking contact. Because if you're maliciously attacked by somebody who wants to do you harm and you're in the right place, or let's call it the wrong place at the wrong time, then they will push through that. And you might be in a position where nothing you scream, nothing you say, and nothing you do is going to help you. So situational awareness with the right tactics is the solution. Lastly, outside of the conversation, I would create scenarios where I would say to her, what if this happened? And even set up a training protocol or find a training location, like Fieldcraft Survival, obviously, that trains these scenarios in different ways to be able to give her tactics and then have her be immersed and conditioned in stress working through those tactics. It's easy to watch a YouTube video, but what do you do in real life when you haven't considered the stress and the physiological changes that take place under that stress? That's what conditioning or stress inoculation is. Very wordy, I'm sorry. It's a podcast. That's what I have to do, but I wanted to give you some thoughts. It's not as easy as step one, step two, step three. It's the idea. And then it's you taking a progressive path to being better prepared. Guys, I appreciate you. Mike Force Podcast. Until next time. Peace out. Tip of the spear.